Welcome to another episode of Evidence-Based EI. This is Leandro. I'm one of the internal medicines at the Cleveland Clinic, and I'm here with Dr. Anna Locke, professor of medicine at the University of Michigan, and one of the authors of the Hepatitis B virus guideline that was just released in December 2025. How are you, Dr. Locke?
Great.
Really nice to meet you. Really nice to have you here. So we're going to discuss some of the main questions we have come up with for this new guideline. And I would like to start with a general basic question. So there has been 7 years between one guideline that was released in 2018 and this one in 2025. What do you think that is meaningful evidence that have come up with in the last 7 years that led to the creation of this new update?
So the update is not just about new information, but also the last time we did it, actually we had one in, I think, 2015, 2016, which is based on PICO and GRADE, systematic review and meta-analysis. And in 2018 is more of a guidance where we cover other topics that are not necessarily based on systematic review and not as stringent. It allows us to cover other topics. And one of the drivers for updating is a lot of people say that the guidelines are too complicated and too restrictive. We now have more evidence and experience that the antivirals are very safe. Can we loosen the indications with treatment? So that was one of the major drivers. And there were some subgroups in home in the past, we didn't feel like the benefit, the evidence to support benefit of treatment is very strong. So we had said monitor and don't start on treatment. And we hear a lot of our patients, as well as a lot of our colleagues, saying, well, we know that this is very safe. If the patient wants to start on treatment, can we not treat them? So we want to re-examine some of the questions that really a lot of people have been asking about. It's not just about new data, but also a new approach as we get more experience.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we have noticed, that there is definitely a new approach. And one of those, for multiple physicians, they have come up with this new question regarding the antiviral therapy for patients in the gray zone. So maybe some of our audience have these questions as well. So maybe we can clarify a little bit what is the gray zone, first of all, and second of all, how to decide whether to treat or not patients in this gray zone, because the guideline left that as a short decision making and sometimes can be difficult to make.
So hepatitis B is a very dynamic disease. Unlike hepatitis C, for example, where you go from an early stage to an intermediate stage to more advanced stage. Hepatitis B, we know that some virus level can be very high early on, then it fluctuates, then it may go to very low levels, then it goes up again. So it is a disease in which it doesn't go from early to intermediate to advanced. It sometimes goes to sleep and sometimes explode like a volcano. And then it goes to sleep again and it wakes up again. And this is the reason why when everyone say, can you actually make the guidelines simpler? Well, if the disease is complex, you can only make it so simple. And one of the things that I have been saying is, many people say, why can't we just put everyone who's HBs antigen positive on treatment? That's the simplest, right? You don't need to worry about the liver enzyme, the fibrosis stage, do you have cirrhosis, the virus level. Now, in all areas of medicine, we're moving away from one size fits all to precision medicine and to personalized medicine. Hepatitis B is the only area in which I hear experts and patients say, treat me like my neighbor. You are different from your neighbor. You are unique. You're special. You deserve that we understand you, your disease, and your preference. So that's really the nuances. Now, of course, you can make it simple by adopting one size fits all, but that's not good medicine, right? So when we talk about gray zone, it goes back to because of the dynamic balance between the immune system trying to control the virus and the virus trying to get out of control and start multiplying. And you don't have the same balance every day throughout decades. So at times, the virus is more active and at times it's less active. And of course, the longer the virus infection goes on, the more likely you have cumulative damage, and then you start progressing to fibrosis and cirrhosis. We typically say that the early phase, the patients are Janogen positive, and the later phase, they're Janogen negative. Within the Janogen positive phase, particularly for perinatally acquired infection, the initial phase, very high levels of virus, and your delivery enzymes are pretty normal. So we said it, oh, that steam intolerant phase, people don't like that term because it's based on clinical markers and not immunological markers. And then you have a later phase in which the patients are still Janogen positive, but you start seeing liver injury, which we think is immune mediated. And you see that the virus DNA levels start going down, but it's not like just go down like this. It can go up and down. And the liver enzymes can also go up and down. If the patients are then lucky, they seroconvert from yeast to anti-yeast, they may go into a quiescent phase, which we call inactive phase, low DNA, normal liver enzymes. And at a later stage, it goes up again. But in order to define these different phases, you have to set cutoff for liver enzymes and HBV DNA. And these cutoffs are by nature very arbitrary because a patient might have DNA that is high but not high enough, liver enzyme that is close to normal but not exactly normal. And so they don't fit into any of these phases. They fall in between. And that's what we call gray zone. Some people call it indeterminate phase. But essentially, they don't fit into any bucket. I'm going to close the door. And they're more common among the Janogen negative patients. Some studies estimate if you look at patients at one point in time, as many as 30 to 50% of Janogen negative patients would be considered to be in the gray zone. The two big categories of gray zone patients, one category would be the patients with low DNA, which is less than 2,000, and yet the liver enzymes are elevated. And the other group would be the patients with high DNA, more than 2,000, but the liver enzymes are normal. And they may have different prognostic indication and underlying factors. The people with low DNA, sometimes you see patients with DNA of 50, 60 IU per ml. And yet the liver enzymes are 60, 70. Well, what might be causing it? This day and age, the most common reason is mast cell. And of course, some of them actually have met ALD. Some of them might have overtly ALD because people with hepatitis B can also be drinking, can also have obesity, metabolic risk factors. And these are the patients that in the other group would have higher DNA. It might be 10,000, 15,000, yet the liver enzymes are normal. And there are not good data to show whether antiviral treatment would benefit these patients. Many, many studies have shown that if you follow these patients over time, some of them do end up with hepatocellular carcinoma. Some of them do end up with liver-related mortality. It's not surprising because some of them do have high virus level and we don't treat them, it may progress. But also some of these observation studies that report high incidence of bad outcome, if you pay attention, read those papers carefully, some of them have not been monitoring the patients closely. What we recommend is, in order to define which phase the patient's in, knowing that this is a dynamic disease, you do not rely on testing at one single time point. Because if you see a 50-year-old Asian patient who might be infected at birth, how can one day tell you the whole story of what happened in the last 50 years? So what we always recommend is, you see the patient, you get all the testing. If the patient has active virus replication, advanced disease, go ahead and start a patient on treatment. Patient has sort of milder disease, indeterminate, repeat the testing every 3 to 6 months for the first year. Because of a very elegant study in Hong Kong where they analyzed some 18,000 people, they realized that during the first year from presentation, 50% of the patients transition out of the gray zone, a quarter of them into more active phase, a quarter of them into the inactive phase, and half of them are still making up their mind. Now, by doing so, you would, if they have now migrated to more active phase, you would have put them on treatment and would have reduced the risk of adverse outcome. If they've migrated to the inactive phase, you can watch them. If they continue to be in a gray zone, then you have to start scratching your head. What do I do? And that's when you try to figure out which subpopulation. Now, if they have low virus level and yet high liver enzymes, you look for other explanations of the high liver enzymes. If they've been drinking heavily, antiviral treatment might not help them. You need to counsel them on the alcohol use. If they have BMI of 35 and they are diabetic and the triglyceride level is high, putting them on antiviral treatment and ignoring the other metabolic factors is not going to help your patient. So you want to look for these other causes and tackle the underlying cause while you continue to monitor the patient. I understand many people say, but you know, that requires that I remember to monitor patient. Well, I hope that we're all good doctors. We remember to monitor patients. The tricky part is sometimes the patients don't cooperate. They don't come back. They don't get the testing done. And yes, continue to monitor patients over time is important. But after you monitor for a while, if they continue to stay in a gray zone, you can't just sit on the fence forever, right? And you have to make some decisions. And here's where we sort of say, okay, what are the factors associated with higher risk of liver cancer adverse outcome? Patient is older, men versus women. And of course, these are patients who don't have evidence of advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, because if they have evidence of advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, you put them on treatment. And the NICE systematic review and meta-analysis published in JHAB 2 years ago showed that men older age, lowish platelet count, low normal might be an indication of advanced fibrosis, early evidence of portal hypertension. And these are the patients in whom treatment might have a better chance of benefiting the patients. If you're dealing with a younger patient, platelet count rock solid normal, non-invasive tests, I'm sure the fibrosis is minimal. The evidence in support of antiviral treatment, it's not there. Many people say, well, treatment can benefit a patient. Even if the evidence is not that strong, why don't we put everyone on treatment? Then we don't need to worry about monitoring the patient. I don't know of any healthcare system, any country which can say, well, I don't think I can keep monitoring the patient. So I'm going to put everyone on treatment, give them a prescription for the next 40 years and never need to see them again. First of all, no health insurance, no country's national health insurance will allow you to give a prescription for 40 years and not see the patient. Second, if you give the patient a prescription and say, I don't need to see you again, do you think the patient would actually continue to take the medicine? Mm-mm. Right? Yep. So we still need to monitor the patient. And we also know that antiviral therapy, even when the virus DNA is completely suppressed, reduces the risk of liver cancer, does not completely eliminate that risk. So to say that if I put everyone on treatment, I don't need to monitor and everyone will be good, that's not true. And the other reason why we were not making a strong push to put everyone on treatment is, if you pay attention to the systematic review that we cited in the guidelines, there were two factors associated with the risk of XCC. One, retrospective studies show a higher incidence of XCC compared to prospective studies. Two, high-quality studies are associated with a lower risk of XCC. We'll say, how can that be? Well, if you pay attention, it is because retrospective studies in general, the patients are followed in a very haphazard manner. Some of them have long gaps in between. There was one observational study that I always cite in my talks, where the patients got ALT testing every 1.2 years, HBV DNA testing every 3.8 years. That's bad care. That's why bad outcomes happen to the patients, because you basically forgot about them. And so high quality studies are the ones in whom you actually observe the patient for a while and determine they truly are in a gray zone and not migrating to another state. You're also monitoring patients carefully. And when they actually migrate to the more active state, you put them on treatment. Therefore, the incidence of HCC is altered. So why do we then sort of say, share decision-making instead of, oh, don't treat? Well, we recognize that in real life, sometimes it is challenging. There are gaps in follow-up. And as we discussed earlier on, knowing now that the current antivirals are very safe, even after using it for 10, 15, 20 years, and the risk of drug resistance is so low that if you have a patient who really wants to be on treatment because they are worried, or they may have family history, they may know of friends who have adverse outcome, and they ask you, doc, can I start on treatment? Why can't I? There's no reason not to start them on treatment. because we give them the benefit of the doubt. What do we mean by shared decision making? You basically discuss with the patient, based on all the testing, we think that your risk of having a bad outcome is high, intermediate, or low, but also be very honest and say that, look, our prediction is our prediction. It's not always correct, right? Antiviral treatment has been shown very clearly to benefit patients with advanced disease, with active disease, with high virus level. The evidence in support of a benefit in patients with milder disease, lower virus replication, it's so-so. However, there is no evidence of a harm. And so in this case, if the patient is very eager to get treated, I would say, okay, we can get you on treatment. But remember, once we start on treatment, don't just stop without letting us know. Because if you take the treatment and then you stop and then you disappear and not come back until you feel sick, then we may be talking about liver transplant, which is not good. Shared decision making is really discussing what will happen if we treat, what will happen if we don't treat, and making sure the patient completely understands before you make that decision. After you discuss, honestly, I find that some of my patients say, well, I'm comfortable with not starting treatment now. And when we talk about shared decision making, it's not just a one-time discussion. Because some of my patients, I've been following them, monitoring them for 15, 20 years. Okay, every time they come back, or I wave at them over Zoom with virtual visits these days, I would say, let's review the test results that you had. Let's review your ultrasound results. Let's review your symptoms. And yeah, everything is the same as in the last 5 years. Oh no, the virus DNA seems to be creeping out a little bit. And because it's not going to be static, so you want to rediscuss what's the current situation. And sometimes it may be stable, and yet the patient is now 8 years older. Their life situation has changed. And they may say, we've been watching for a while. Yeah, it's not getting worse, but it's not getting better either. Shouldn't I be starting treatment now? So shared decision making is a good discussion after the initial evaluation, but rediscussion at every encounter. And that's the key.
Incredible teaching points, Dr. Locke, and I think you walk us through all the important points about the gray zone, when to start treatment, and what are the benefits of that. I would like to now jump into when to stop treatment and when to withdraw treatment. And I see that the AASLD now suggests withdrawing therapy not until the hepatitis B surface antigen is completely undetectable. And that goes against some of the other societies, like the European and Asian Pacific Society. What do you think that, why is this transition in this new guideline, and there is discrepancies between guidelines in the world about this topic?
So why can't we harmonize the guidelines? Why can't the world be the same in every society? Education systems is different in every country. Healthcare system is different in every country. Your maximum speed when you drive on a highway is also different. Why are they different? Because each country has different resources, has different needs. The disease is more common in one part of the world than in another. And therefore, there are all these differences. The Asian Pacific Association was actually the first to say, well, we can stop treatment after 2-3 years. At that time, it was completely financially driven, because people just can't afford to be on treatment for long. And in some countries, for example, in Taiwan, where the government was very generous. If you have cirrhosis, we cover the treatment. If you don't have cirrhosis, we cover for 2 years, 3 years. You want to stay on treatment, you're on your own. And that's really what drove a lot of those nuke withdrawal studies. And there are a lot of problems with those studies, because basically the patients who can afford the treatment continue the treatment, the patient who cannot afford the treatment stop the treatment. And it was an experiment by nature, a biased nature, depending on whether you can afford it or whether you want to prioritize spending your money on continue on nuke or not. And what was surprising was they found that some patients, when you stop the nuke, they actually went on to lose surface antigen. Whereas if the patients stay on nuke, we rarely ever encounter the patients clearing surface antigen. And that led to sort of one study after another. But the literature show very clearly that in some patients, taking them off nuke does seem to increase the likelihood of S antigen loss. It's mostly related to how low the service engine level is at a time when you stop the new, which is not surprising. How can you get to S engine loss unless it has been dropping, right? And the ones in whom the S engine level dropped to very low level, they're probably the patients in home. After a couple of years of new and suppressed virus, the immune system is beginning to restore and recover, and it's able to keep the S antigen level low. And when you start the treatment, maybe the recovered immune system is able to continue to drive the S antigen level. So the studies also show that there's a big difference between Asians and white patients. From Asian patients, if the S antigen level is less than 100, then there's a decent chance of S antigen loss when you stop the new. But if the S antigen is between 100 to 1,000, you get like very minimal chance of S antigen loss, and all you get is really flares. So the risks way outweigh the benefit. But in the white patients, Caucasian patients, it's completely different. If the S antigen is less than 1,000, they have a reasonable chance of S antigen loss. Why is that the difference? We don't completely understand. I personally think that it may be related to immune recovery. The Asian patients have been infected for much longer, or they have been infected at birth. The immune response is not as good. So even after suppressing with a nuke for a long time, there's minimal recovery. You have to really drive the S antigen to much lower to have a chance. So we talk about a potential benefit, which is S antigen loss. But we got to remember, there's the other side. Because in almost all patients, when you stop treatment, the virus DNA does become detectable again. Some patients are lucky. When it comes back, the DNA stays at low level. And maybe that restored immune system is able to suppress the virus and take care of it. But in other patients, up to 30-50% of patients, the DNA keeps rising and patients can have hepatitis flare. And if you weren't watching the patient closely, you can sort of see them become jaundiced and decompensate in front of your eyes. And every single study where they report on nuke withdrawal have observed decompensation and even mortality. So it's really a risky game, which you have to really be very careful about. And this is the reason why ASLD say we do not recommend that we would systematically take patients off nuke. However, again, shared decision making. For patients who really ask, who want to consider, I've been on treatment for 6 years, can I stop now? You say, okay, well, let's one, confirm that we never have any evidence that you have advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis. If that's the case, forget about it, okay? And two, we're going to get the test for quantitative surface antigen to make sure that it is low. If it is sky high, there will be no benefit, only risk. If it is low, and even the Europeans say, we prefer it to be less than 100, not less than 1,000. So if the quantitative S is less than 100, then we can consider it. But as we discussed, the patient then needs to agree to much closer monitoring. With the current nukes that are so safe with low risk of drug resistance, in my practice, after the virus DNA has been suppressed, I have the patients get blood tests every 6 months, and I follow them only once a year, sometimes even virtual visit and not in-person visit. But I tell the patient, you want to stop treatment if you meet all the criteria and we decide to stop. I'm going to need you to have blood tests at least every 1 or 2 months or the next 6 to 12 months, because I want to make sure that if the DNA goes crazy high, if the liver enzymes go crazy high, we're going to immediately put you back on treatment and not take chances. And some of the patients say, wow, I need to be watched so closely to make sure that I don't get into trouble. Now I'm going to rethink whether I want to take that chance. And that's really what shared decision making is. Because if you just say, because some of my patients do ask, I heard that stopping might be beneficial. Yes, but there are two sides of the coin. Okay, let's look at the other side. Let's see the whole picture. Then you can decide. But please, I don't want to hurt you. So if we decide to stop, you got to promise me you're going to get your testing done.
Okay, that's great. That's awesome. Really nice teaching points and really well explained to you. Amazing. So we have now talked about why we did the new update. We have talked about when to start treatment, when to withdraw treatment, HCC surveillance. We briefly talked about it too. There is another teaching point that the Hepatitis B guidelines came up with multiple new recommendations that, of course, would be difficult to go through them, but maybe we can mention some of them and some suggestions. And this topic is more mother to child transmission of hepatitis B. I would like to ask you, what are your suggestions for any hepatologists or general gastroenterologists that need to coordinate this during pregnancy?
So mother-to-child transmission is the most important part in terms of preventing Hep B infection. And this is because the risk of going from acute infection to chronic infection is highest if infection occurs during the at birth or during the first year of life. Infection acquired during infancy, it's 90% risk of going on to chronic infection. Infection during early childhood between the age of 1 to 5 years is about 30-40%. Whereas with adult acquired infection, if the person is immunocompetent, the risk of chronic infection is less than 5%. So preventing mother-to-child transmission is not just preventing infection, but preventing chronic infection and all the sequelae of chronic infection. This is why it is so important. Well, vaccinating newborn babies and giving HBG hepatitis B immune globulin if the mother is Hep B surface antigen positive, those have been in the policies in most countries since the late 80s and early 90s. What has been sort of new in the last 10 years is the recognition that even if all that is done right, baby get the first dose of hepatitis B vaccine within the first 12 hours of birth, get a dose of hepatitis B immune globulin within the first 12 hours of birth, finish the vaccine series, it's not 100% protection. Why? And the failures are really in cases where the mother has extremely high virus DNA level, more than 200,000 IU per ml. Because we know that vaccine does not induce antibody immediately. It takes a while for the immunity to build up. The HBIC provides immediate protection, but then it only lasts for so long if you give one dose of HBIC. And when the mother has extremely high virus DNA level, and with hepatitis B, particularly with young mothers, e antigen positive, the virus DNA level can be 8 logs, 9 logs, so a billion, a trillion. And so you can imagine a baby sort of swimming out, coming out of the through the mother's vagina, soaking the mother's blood, which has a trillion IU per ml of the virus. All you need is really a few of that get into the baby's system, and the baby can then get infected. So then people say, well, why don't we do what HIV situation is? In HIV, when a mother is infected, there's also a very high chance that the baby gets infected. There's no vaccine. So the only way to protect the baby is to make sure that you put the mother on antiretroviral, reduce the viral load so that you cut down on the risk of transmitting to the baby. And because in hepatitis B, some of our antiviral is the same as those used in HIV, tenofovir, right? And tenofovir is used in HIV, and tenofovir can be used in hepatitis B. And the experience with HIV allow us to show that it is safe to use in pregnancy. Then they don't have any choice, because if you don't protect the baby, they're born with HIV, right? And so there's an antiretroviral pregnancy registry, which has tracked thousands of mother-child pair and show that it is unsafe. So we said, well, why can't we treat pregnant women who are found to be surface antigen positive, high DNA, and put them on antiretroviral, put them on tenofovir? And we were still a little concerned because with Hep B, unlike HIV, we can have vaccine, we can have HBA. So we don't want to treat during the first trimester. And we're going to start in late second, early third trimester. And we don't need to knock the virus down to totally undetectable because we do have vaccine and all that. We just want to lower it to lower level. Because in the natural studies, it's been shown that if the mother has low DNA level, you give HBIC, you give a vaccine, the baby's infection rate is really less than 1%, close to zero. So we don't need to knock it all the way down. Now, the new thing here is in our previous recommendation, that was some 2016, 2018. This approach was still sort of fairly early. So we made that recommendation, but we were not like pushing, not a strong recommendation. And now with much more data and really multiple studies, systematic review, we said we need to come out strong. The other point was At that time, we only had TDF, but since then we have TAF, and obviously there are more data on with TDF than with TAF, but there are increasing number of studies with TAF as well. So we feel comfortable to say that you can use either one of them. Yeah, we have more data on TDF, but TAF is just as good.
That's amazing that we have also learned about more to shell transmission, and we invite all our listeners to read the full guideline for more details. However, this podcast have walked us through the most important information that the guideline is providing us. And I would like to thank Dr. Locke for being here with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.